In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
One of the problems we have today is that Marxists, communists, socialists, progressives, the authoritarians, these people simply do not perceive the world the way that we do. They don't even have the same thought processes to begin to see the world the way that we do. So there's no commonality. It's not just a different language or use of language, but it's an entirely different worldview that wants to enslave others to their worldview, to put themselves in power at the expense of your freedoms and rights so they can be happy, not really caring if the people they rule are happy or miserable. And it is only by embracing this false religion will you be allowed to have some semblance of happiness. The whole of Marxist authoritarian thinking depends on hate, ironically while claiming to love and care for people. But the end result is that when they get into power, you see examples of hate, not love, and of caring for one's fellow man. And of course, you don't need to actually care for anyone because people aren't individuals. They have no rights except the ones you allow them to practice. And even then, they can be taken away because, well, it's Thursday. Imagine for a moment your worst enemy, someone who truly hates you, everything about you, your religion, your faith, your family, what you do for a living, your way of just going about living your life. Now imagine that person with legal power over you and your business, controlling your religion, controlling aspects of your family, legal power over your entire life. That's the point of a limited government, so that if your worst enemy gets elected, they don't have power over you. And if you get elected, you don't have power over them. Our founders put in place a government that protects your individual liberty, regardless of who is in power, and not one that empowers those who hate you or who hate America. Today's show is part one of a look at how we got here, where the law and especially the Constitution simply don't matter anymore, how anti-America as founded forces have corrupted our system and seized power to give themselves ultimate and absolute power. Today we are joined by a very special guest. We're talking with Jonathan Emord. He's a distinguished attorney who leads the top-rated firm Emord & Associates based in Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Arizona. Since 1985, Jonathan has specialized in constitutional law, federal administrative law, and complex civil litigations. He's got a new book out there that is going to form the basis for 2 weeks of show here, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Jonathan, it is an honor to talk to you today.
Well, it's a privilege to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. You know, just in researching the show, I've seen some interviews and some presentations that you've done, and I just really want to talk to you about some of those. And of course, we'll be getting into your book, The Authoritarians, although we're going to save a lot of that, I think, for next week. But let's start with you. One of the interviews that I had come across from 2014 dealt with corruption at the FDA, and another more recent one said that you had defeated the FDA 8 times in federal courts, more so than any other attorney. And I just absolutely love that. I mean, that's really impressive. So is the FDA a particular focus of yours?
It has been because of the extreme degree of censorship that has characterized the way the FDA has operated since the 1930s. The FDA really is limiting the amount of information in the health marketplace to such a great extent that it's sacrificing people's lives, it's hurting their health. Of course, people don't realize that because you don't know what you don't know, but when the information is available in the scientific literature and is kept there, you have an elite body of people who are aware of it and who benefit from it, but the rest of us are denied it, and so we don't modify our behavior or accept into our diet certain elements that are critical for our health. And it's not just in the context of dietary supplements and food elements, but it's also in the drug context as well. You know, so it's a censorship that is driven by a protectionist regime over there, and you have the leadership of the agency invariably favors the positions taken by the largest firms and protects them from competition from upstarts. And the problem is that politics rules over science.
Yes.
And as a consequence, what's best oftentimes is suppressed in favor of protecting the market position of companies. The corruption is extraordinary. It's manifest in virtually every decision issued by the FDA on any important question.
Well, we have certainly seen a lot of corruption coming out in the last 2 years here since COVID broke out. And especially all of these assaults on constitutional freedoms, individual freedom, individual liberty. And something that has been bugging me this entire time is, where have all of the lawyers been during this usurpation of our Constitution and basic rights? I mean, it just seems like there ought to be 1,000 lawsuits every day, and yet you've got these communist Democrats running things. Where are all the lawyers?
Well, it's a good question. We have a lot of litigation that is about to happen as soon as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration issues the emergency temporary standard imposing Biden's vaccine mandate on over 100 million American workers, or an alternative, a weekly testing requirement. That is going to face a stiff amount of litigation from some 14 different states, as well as hundreds of, if not thousands of individuals and hundreds of companies. So it'll be the most litigated act of the federal government since the National Industrial Recovery Act in the 1930s, which suffered enormous amounts of litigation. I think the reason why you're not seeing more litigation is that, on the one hand, potential plaintiffs are intimidated by fear that if they are identified and lose, that they will be subjected to punishments from their states, their local authorities, or the federal government. So you have, for example, very brave individuals who have filed suit and are exceptional. In the face of threats of law enforcement shutting their businesses down and arresting them, but more larger concerns, just trying to weather the storm, so to speak, thinking that, gee, this is horrible, this is costing us a fortune, but if we litigate, we may be made into a pariah, and it may destroy our market, and it may hurt us individually, and we may end up getting arrested. So a lot of people are intimidated by the power that has been brought to bear by the localities, the feds, or the states and the feds in enforcing this. But clearly there are constitutional problems that are
absolutely
enormous,
yeah,
and there
absolutely
are also statutory problems. Under federal statutory law, there are.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, there are a lot of problems.
Okay, time for a break. Coming up, could COVID ironically be the undoing of government overreach? Lots more with Jonathan E. Mord, constitutional lawyer and author of the new book, The Authoritarians. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan E. Mord, author of The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. If you want to know what on earth is happening in America and how we got here and how to get out of it, this is the book for you. Jonathan, you were mentioning there in that last segment about all of these lawsuits that are coming forward. Ironically enough, could this overreach by the Biden administration to mandate vaccines invade a person's, not only their liberty, but their own body? Could this be what finally opens the floodgates to start disbanding some of these overreaching agencies?
I think so. Biden's popularity in the latest Quinnipiac poll is down to 38%. I don't think that's where it's going to end. I think it's going to continue to plummet. And I believe it's because of these extraordinary overreaches. In the first instance, I think the public is not fooled by how cynical this is. Biden's popularity was already plummeting because of the Afghanistan debacle and his abandonment of Americans and SIV holders and allies in Afghanistan to the terrorist Taliban. And in other words, sacrificing them to the Taliban because of the threat to their lives. And people did not sit well with them that the president cut and run, forced the military to cut and run. and abandon over $80 billion of military hardware and trillions of dollars in the most sophisticated bases that we had established, not least of which is Bagram, and then a total loss of on-the-ground intelligence. So that whole episode has caused people to look with revulsion on the commander-in-chief for dereliction of duty, and he's tried to pivot with this in a really rather cynical way, this mandate for businesses with over 100 employees, and the result has been that from the get-go, the cynicism and the lack of sincerity has come out. You have a memo from Ron Klain, the chief of staff of the White House, which admitted that this was a quote-unquote ultimate workaround,
yes,
meaning a workaround the Constitution and federal law. And then in addition, you have the president off the bat excluding the United States Post Office from the mandate.
Yes.
The post office, of course, people come to your door every day, right?
And
in-person connection.
Yeah, and members of Congress are all immune from these mandates.
Members of Congress, and then the Supreme Court and the federal courts. And then you have, of course, no effort whatsoever to screen illegal immigrants coming across the southern border to determine whether or not they have COVID, just allowing them in with COVID, and then distributing them around the country. You've got a real hypocrisy working here. He tried to pivot in this way because over 60% of registered Democrats were in favor of a mask mandate. But he did it in the most sophomoric way because one thing that, you know, the most basic lesson one learns is that you don't slap someone in the face and then ask them to do you a favor.
Right.
And, of course, that's what he did with the unvaccinated. His speech was basically a slap in the face to every person who isn't vaccinated in the country, condemning them and raising the specter of a conflict between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. And then he never explained the necessity of it. Right off the bat, you've got a real problem under federal law, by the way. So even if you discount, which you shouldn't, but discount the constitutional problems, the separation of powers problems, and the problem of 10th Amendment violation that's inherent when the federal government, for the first time in American history, assumes a state power that in Jacobson versus the Massachusetts was said to be reserved to the states, the power to compel vaccination. Even if you discount those constitutional violations, he violates the very statute he's using as a basis to impose this mandate. The president is relying on Section 61 of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and that act allows an emergency temporary standard to be issued, but only in the most selective circumstances. In the first instance, there has to be posed to the workforce in a particular industry a grave danger, and that grave danger has been defined by the Fifth Circuit to be a mortal threat. In other words, and it must arise from an agent that's in the workforce that is capable of remediation, such that if the action that is recommended in the emergency temporary standards is imposed, it would have to be one that is necessary to eliminate the grave danger. The problem that the administration confronts is enormous on that front.
Well, just in terms of the whole grave danger thing, we are where we are dealing with a virus that has a 99.8% recovery rate. So
exactly.
I mean, that's the really crazy thing about this that I've never understood. We have upended society for something that in any other situation you'd be guaranteed to survive.
And not only that, you're absolutely right, but with regard to the workforce population, almost all people in the workforce population are under the age of 65 and are healthy individuals to begin with. But then in addition, so that figure you're citing is quite accurate, in addition, not only is there an extraordinary recovery rate, so there isn't a grave danger, but in addition, you've got roughly 100 to 110 million Americans who have natural immunity, which is more fulsome than the immunity obtainable
from
vaccination.
Yep.
So that population in the workforce does not pose a grave danger. Then you have an enormous segment of the population that works from home. They aren't even exposing themselves to others. So how could they pose a grave danger? And then how does a truck driver who's in a cab all alone? How does he pose a grave danger to anyone? And then within the workforce itself, employers have already created all sorts of means by which to minimize the risks of transmission.
Right.
So there isn't the grave danger. And as a consequence, this thing is likely to hit the federal shoals of justice pretty hard and not be able to rise up.
Boy,
I think he's going to lose.
Yeah, I sure hope so. It seems like the only grave danger is the grave danger to their power. That's what they're really upset about.
Really horrible. And the burdens are immense.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, time for a quick break. We'll continue our conversation with Jonathan Emord, constitutional attorney and author of the new book, The Authoritarians. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Emord. That's E-M-O-R-D. He's one of the nation's top constitutional lawyers, and today's the teaser really to whet your appetite for next week's show when we will be more fully exploring his book, The Authoritarians. And Jonathan, you gave a great presentation, a truly brilliant one, back in Minneapolis, November 2011, to the Citizens Council for Health Freedom, titled The Way Back to Liberty. I mean, it was in the shadow of Obamacare being passed and the fight to undo the personal mandate. And I just really like to pull some points from that because I think it adds some real context to your latest book here. In that presentation, you said, we are on the brink of collapse of liberty. And that was just truly prophetic at the time.
Well, thank you for that. I think that we have been for some time experiencing a rise through the administrative state in unbridled federal power. One of the most remarkable things about the growth of the federal government, which is almost exclusively in the administrative state, is just how the Constitution does not apply to the administrative state. And people don't realize this, that they are really tyrannized by the actions of administrative agencies. So, for example, basic protections that would exist in a federal court don't exist in an administrative agency. You don't have a right to a trial by jury. You don't have a right to confront your accuser. You don't have a presumption of innocence that goes with you. Rather, you're presumed guilty until you prove yourself innocent in an administrative context. And then you don't have a right to set charges. You don't have a right to discovery against the government. The charges morph during the course of a case, and you don't even have the right to know that. There's no requirement that the government amend its charges, so the government can, at the last minute, alter its charges against you and condemn you, never having afforded you due process or the right to argue against those things. So you don't have a right to due process. They are the modern day equivalent of the courts of Star Chamber and of High Commission from the 16th and 17th century England.
Yes.
Where you have political tribunals that charge you. If, for example, an administrative agency is the ultimate prosecutor, it charges you with the offense. And yet, it's also the ultimate judge. Mm-hmm. So the prosecutor is also the judge. In such a system, there can be no justice. It's no wonder that almost 99% of all cases brought in administrative agency context are in favor of the agency. The agency only decides against itself, of course, very rarely. And it's such an extraordinary event that you're almost assured a condemnation. Then, unfortunately, under Chevron, the constitutional decision about deference to administrative agencies, there are others too, the courts defer to the agency's findings of fact and conclusions of law. They don't have what's known as a de novo review, that is a new review of the evidence. They just defer. And so you're stuck with a system that's rigged against you. And so that horrendous thing that was created in the 1880s in America and then expanded massively during the New Deal is the bane of liberty in this country. So when I spoke at that time, I was talking about those abuses that stem from the administrative agency. But it has now been put on steroids by, for example, Joe Biden's order we were just talking about. It's no coincidence that rather than go to Congress and fight for a law that would impose a mandate on industry, he simply avoids that constitutional obligation and gives the power to an administrative agency by ordering that agency to directly impose it without any opportunity for public participation, without any opportunity for debate, even in violation of even as an exception to the Administrative Procedure Act. There isn't even a notice and comment rulemaking. It's just a direct order And this is dictatorial. This is the mark of a authoritarian. It's the mark of a dictator.
Right.
He's chosen that method because he does not respect constitutional limits on his power.
Well,
and that's horrendous.
It absolutely is horrendous. And in that presentation, you mentioned James Madison, who had said that if the powers from any two branches of government were held in single hands, that would be the definition of tyranny. And like you just said, I mean, that's essentially what we have now, where we have executive orders that effectively replace laws. But why doesn't Congress ever challenge these?
Congress has become, it's become politically advantageous for Congress to avoid responsibility to the electorate. So, for example, Congress created, of course, all these administrative agencies in the
right.
first instance.
Right.
And they've turned over the power of governance to them. They've given them, as you point out, which James Madison described as the very definition of tyranny, a combination of legislative, executive, and judicial powers, and placed them in single hands, which he said is the very definition of tyranny. And so you have this situation where Congress, under Article 1, is supposed to be the exclusive creator of laws in the federal system. You're not supposed to have lawmaking by the executive. And yet we have all of these administrative agencies that promulgate tens of thousands of regulations, and those regulations have the full force and effect of law, and yet no one ever voted into office the heads of these agencies. They're appointed. And these agencies adopt these regulations, and they're not subject to review by the courts, the Congress, the American people. So you have true tyrannical power, and it was intentional. The horror of this is that those who created the administrative agencies intended very specifically for them to exceed the constitutional limits, to create a government outside of the constitutional government. In fact, they had disdain, even hatred, for the Constitution and its limits on powers. And they intended for the administrative agencies to be efficient and to have be entirely unencumbered in their dictatorial rule. So that's the legacy of a progressive agenda in the progressive era and forward, which has been ruinous to our country. It has been a bane on the free enterprise system. It has been harmful to specific individuals who have been crushed by this system without any recourse. And it's high time we got rid of the administrative state. If we truly want a free country, we have to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Stay with us. We will be right back with Jonathan Emord, constitutional attorney and author of The Authoritarians. And welcome back. Jonathan Emord is the author of the incredibly important book, The Authoritarians. This book is so timely and so on point that we're going to be having him back next week as well. And Jonathan, you mentioned a while ago the fact that the federal government is essentially the prosecutor and the judge. And now we've got a situation where the Department of Justice, the FBI, the CIA, they're out there actually planting evidence. So you've got that abuse of police power where they essentially plant evidence on somebody like either General Flynn or President Trump, where they started the whole Russia collusion thing. Brennan's own notes mentioned that they knew that this was a Hillary plant, and yet they proceeded anyway. So the situation is, though, is we are effectively depending on elected officials to rein in power that they've abdicated. How do we get back to a constitutional process? Is that going to depend on a strong Congress or a strong president or some combination thereof?
Yeah, it's going to require both. It's going to require people who are dedicated to liberty and believe in the Constitution's limits on powers to make good on the promise of the Constitution by enforcing it. James Madison also warned that the Constitution would become but a mere parchment barrier to power if those in power were so corrupt as to dedicate themselves to enhancing their own powers at the expense of the people and the limits on power in the Constitution. We have to give the Constitution life. And we have a court that is moving in that direction. We need more justices predisposed to doing that and courageous enough to do it against the threats that are oftentimes brought by Schumer and other tyrants against the court. And realize that if we go ahead and do that, if we expend the resources necessary to rein in these powers, we are protecting future generations from a tyranny that is what you're describing. when the Department of Justice, when the FBI, when those who are entrusted with upholding the Constitution and the laws of the country abuse that trust and then plant evidence or go after officials who are innocent of wrongdoing in order to advance the political cause of their opponents, we obviously are very much in a third world country environment where you cannot Yes. trust the very people who are entrusted to defend and uphold the Constitution and the laws of this country. We have to return to a society that is predicated on the rule of law, and it has to be applied evenly, regardless of a person's station.
Yes.
Look, Hillary Clinton escaped what should have been a prison sentence because of her connections with Comey and because of her connections mm-hmm. with the FBI through those that she used and creating, taking a phony dossier to go after Trump to avoid attention on her own direct violation of the Espionage Act by using a personal server against also the Freedom of Information Act and the regulations that govern the State Department. She took information that was supposed to be going into the government repositories and held to be available to the public, had it transferred to a personal server at her house that was entirely unprotected, that we now know is hacked by the Chinese and by the Russians, containing vital information that even identified methods and individuals who are in harm's way serving this country in espionage roles and other roles around the world, and exposed that to others. But even had that not been the case, the mere fact that she had that information transferred to an insecure place violated the Espionage Act, and Comey washed his hands of the affair and let her off the hook, even though every other person in government who had engaged in simply a negligent act of taking confidential information, secret information, home with them by accident on a laptop could see that they would be serving in prison for years. So that is proof positive and has been repeated over and over again of this double standard. That has to be eliminated. If you violate the law, you should go to prison if that's the sentence. And you shouldn't be able to escape it because of who you are
or
what position you have.
Yes, that's exactly right. Getting back to that presentation that you had given, you had mentioned that in the 1930s, in the midst of an economic crisis, FDR said that he was going to end the Depression by expanding government, and he created this massive government bureaucracy that we have now, and that since then, over 250 regulatory commissions are now governing America. And this was one really astounding point of that, is we have a situation now where 90% of laws don't go through Congress, but are instead hatched in the halls of bureaucracy, who are all unelected but all powerful. So back then, when he was pushing that through, why did people fall for that? Why did they go along with it?
Well, they were desperate. They were in the midst of a depression. What they didn't comprehend at the time as well as they should have, there were some who did comprehend it, but they were not, their voices were not heard. They're now heroes of history, I think. But basically what happened was the Great Depression was precipitated by government action. You have the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which we know was the highest tariff in American history on imports of goods, and caused a retaliatory set of tariffs around the world against the United States, basically shutting down exports. And then in addition to that, you had the government raise taxes. Hoover raised taxes. And in addition to that, Hoover was the start, a Republican was the start of the welfare state response to it. And it wasn't because he didn't use drastic measures of welfare. You know, there were over 100 economists, actually I think it may have been 1,000, who wrote to Hoover that if he passed the Smoot-Hawley tariff, it would result in an absolute economic catastrophe in the United States. He said that he promised the electorate that he would raise tariff rates, and therefore he would fulfill his promise. And he didn't deny that there would be economic consequences. He didn't think they would be as grave as they were. But basically, that created a shutdown in that environment. You also had the Federal Reserve, which was manipulating the currency, had been established during the Wilson years. And unfortunately for Hoover, they were restricting, at the very time of the need for capital, they were restricting the availability of capital. So so that companies in the midst of this crisis where they were losing sales internationally and couldn't import goods necessary to produce goods were also restricted in their availability of capital from the banks. This, of course, led to the Great Depression, to Black Friday and the collapse of the marketplace. But it was all precipitated by government action. And the government made it worse during the Roosevelt years. You had all these feverish programs, and you had people like Rexford Guy Tugwell, Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, advocating a Soviet-style economy. A lot of people don't realize even the word New Deal was actually taken from a book that advocated communism. Mm. Roosevelt met with the author of a book called The New Deal. And The New Deal, in its very last page, celebrates the Soviet system of communism as the solution for the world's woes.
Wow.
And he met with these people. He had very cordial relations with people of that bend and brought into his own administration many who were socialists and communists. And he loved the notion of fascism, national socialism. He had Benito Mussolini was a pen pal. He would write Benito Mussolini glowing letters about how magnificent his government-mandated economy was. And he sent over leading people in his administration to Rome to study Benito Mussolini's fascism, and they brought back recommendations to be implemented here. The point is that these people were not dedicated to the principles of liberty. They couldn't care less when it came to liberty. What they were interested in was finding a way to get out of the depression that would also cause them to be viewed assume more power than had ever been assumed by those in governance. And they used, in Rahm Emanuel's words, which could have been applied then, a crisis. They wanted a crisis not to go to waste.
Right. Exactly.
And so they put it to use.
Wow. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Our guest is Jonathan Emort. His book is The Authoritarians. Coming up, we didn't get here because strong men stood in the way. We got here because weak men wouldn't stand in the way. And some of them wore robes. And welcome back. We're talking with constitutional attorney Jonathan Emort. That's E-M-O-R-D. Who truly understands the constitutional crisis that we're facing today. His book is The Authoritarians, and we'll be digging into that in full next week. Jonathan, you had mentioned in that presentation that when FDR was pushing through all of these new regulations and these new agencies and whatnot, that the Supreme Court had initially held this overreach as unconstitutional, which it clearly was. And then to get past that, FDR hatched this court packing plan, and that mere threat caused a switch in time to protect their own skin. Could he have done what he floated and packed the court?
Politically, he could have passed, could not pass the court packing plan. He happened to be very popular at the time. He and his attorney general overestimated his popularity. They thought it would be sufficient for Congress to agree with him to pack the court. He thought it was also coupled with a disingenuous sales pitch. I mean, he presented this as a salutary method of solving the age problem on the court, that there were people who were too old and that was not a good thing to have, and that instead for every person of a certain age and above, he wanted there to be another justice appointed to the Supreme Court, which, of course, was immediately recognized as a political move, not some sort of a reorganization of the court, and for benign or non-political reasons. And he suffered enormous rebuke from both Democrats and Republicans who refused to pass it because they didn't want the political branches to interfere with the operations of the court. They realized that if you opened this, you would open Pandora's box to an endless series of modifications to the court that could be used by Congress and the president to manipulate the court and cause it to lose its independence. The very purpose and the founding principles and doctrines that arise for the judiciary is that it be independent. It was understood that when the judiciary is not independent, as had been the case with the Crown's prosecutors and judges in the colonial period as a vehicle to punish the colonies, They were not independent. And so you had jury nullification, which was used. But as far as getting justice out of judges who were predisposed to protect the crown, there was no hope for the colonists. And so that reinforced their desire to ensure an independent federal judiciary. And that's why you have life tenures in the Constitution. And that's why you have this system, the delicate system of checks and balances, which is utterly rent when you allow Congress to tinker with the court whenever it's dissatisfied with the politics that appear to arise from a decision.
So why did the Supreme Court, those justices, back down when judicial spines were needed the most?
That's a good question. I think they did for a number of reasons that it's kind of hard to pin on any particular justice, but some were intimidated. Some were old and didn't want to go through the fight, as for personal reasons, they didn't want to suffer that rebuke. And some thought that they would go through this for a temporary period of time and then might be able to restore constitutional jurisprudence later on. But the reality was that once they engaged in what a paper of the time called the switch in time that saved nine, once they shifted their ideological views to favor expansion of government without constitutional checks on power, they ushered in this era of ever-expanding federal power and governance, and they removed that principal block that Alexander Hamilton wrote about in the Federalist Papers, that the court was to be guardians of the Constitution, that they were had this unique role because of their life tenure where they would ensure that the Constitution was not violated by statutory law. And so they abdicated that responsibility when time and again they allowed the federal government to expand its power beyond its constitutional limits all the way from then, that time to the present.
You had mentioned earlier that we're going to need courageous courts to untangle the situation that we're in now, this unconstitutional government, essentially. We have a Supreme Court now, ostensibly a 6-3 majority, several of whom have claimed in their appointment hearings, claimed to be firm constitutionalists. Do you think that these court members have the backbone to reverse the FDR-era Supreme Court decisions and start to disband some of these federal government juggernauts?
I hope so. I think certain of the justices do have that predisposition, and they've made it clear in dissents and concurrences over many years. Many of them appear to be coalescing behind the idea of rejecting Chevron deference and restoring meaningful judicial review of federal agency actions. It's up to the political branches to get rid of the independent the regulatory state in favor of a constitutional system whereby members of Congress are exclusively responsible for the making of the laws and are held accountable for those actions. But getting members of Congress to agree to be accountable for all actions taken by the federal government is a large order of business. It again requires that people have integrity and be willing to self-sacrifice in order to advance the Constitution and protect the interests of the American people. Whether they have that willingness is not clear at all, and certainly in many cases is clearly the opposite, that they don't. So it's a combination of action by the courts and the Congress and by the president to ensure that constitutional government is restored. The great benefit of restoring constitutional government would be an enormous expansion in the market, people, and opportunity, and the whole country would be much richer, and we would be much freer. If we did that, we would be enjoying the fruits of our labors. It would return us to a state that Jefferson called for when he defined the sum of good government in his inaugural address. He said, a wise and frugal government shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. And he defined that as the sum of good government. It was then, and it is today still, the sum of good government.
Absolutely. So if you could, if the 2021 version of Jonathan E. Mord could go back in time and talk to that young, optimistic 2011 Jonathan E. Mord giving that presentation, what would you tell him? What would you warn him about?
Well, I think I would tell him that more needed to be done. I was working feverishly as a lawyer, as you mentioned in the introduction. You know, I have this distinction of having defeated the FDA 8 times in federal court, which is a record in American history. But I was convinced at that time that action exclusively through litigation could have a very meaningful impact upon the law, and it did. But the problem is the problem is far greater than just health freedom, for example, and the problem is enormous, infecting all aspects of governance and all aspects of human life. So we need, as we've been discussing, more change. We need political change and we need judicial change in the direction of freedom, in the direction of protecting individual liberty. And it's the challenge is immense today.
Yes.
Because the knee-jerk reaction of government is to seize a crisis and to take full advantage of that crisis to accumulate greater power. And in the process, they deprive people of their liberty, and people are most willing to give up their freedom in exchange for a promise of security. What people have got to realize is that when you're talking about a virus, there is no security,
whether you
give up your freedom or not. And so when someone's trying to sell you on the idea that you can enslave yourself to the state and that will give you greater security, you should immediately remind yourself of the fact that nowhere on earth has that experiment in slavery, in socialism and communism, ever succeeded in benefiting people without severe cost in both their material existence and in their exercise of free agency.
Yes, absolutely.
You can't, you know, and so that's the bigger issue. That's the issue of our time. Will we 2 years hence be free? Will we 4 years hence be free? Are we going to reclaim our legacy? Are we going to recognize that our greatness is predicated on our freedom? There's no other way the American people can be great if they choose a course that is not one dedicated to protecting their individual liberty.
That's exactly right. And it's terrifying to think that we are really truly on the threshold of losing that. Okay, stay with us. We'll wrap things up for this week with Jonathan E. Mord, constitutional attorney and the author of The Authoritarians. Enter our final segment now with Jonathan E. Mord about the subversion of the Constitution due to the rise of the progressives and socialists and communists, anyone who wants to rob you of your God-given rights and freedoms and make you their subjects instead. His book is The Authoritarians, and he'll be back next week to continue this discussion as well. Jonathan, just one more thing from that presentation. To set the stage for the origins of authoritarianism, in that presentation you mentioned Sir Robert Filmer, who wrote Patriarcha in the mid-1600s or so. In that, he defended the concept that only the king had rights and people could only be free so much as the king would allow them to be free to exercise some rights. I mean, that sounds remarkably like what we have now, except instead of a king and aristocrats, we have an elected monarchy. But Sir Robert wasn't the king, so he was essentially arguing to be subservient. Why is it, you think, that some people want to be ruled rather than be free? And for that matter, why is it that people want to give up their freedoms? Do they not understand that giving power, ultimate power, to the government leads to losing their own freedoms?
Well, Sir Rob, you're right. The parallels are striking between the state that we rebelled from in order to found this nation, predicated on the rights of man, the individual freedom of all people, versus a government where all rights are reserved to one leader and everyone else is allowed to operate only by leave of that leader. I suspect that those who give up their freedoms in order to achieve power in the hands of a single individual do so because of a promise that that individual makes of life being different in beneficial ways. For example, the king would promise you security. He would promise you that he would use the power of the state to protect you against marauding invaders, protect you, use his courts to prosecute parties that would steal from you and would otherwise give you protection so long as you abided by his dictates. It was a quid pro quo in which you understood that the king had all the rights and that you had to live in strict obedience to the requirements of the crown and later the crown and parliament. But that was unacceptable to the radical Whigs who opposed the crown because they saw through it. They saw through it that if you don't recognize that rights come from your creator, from God, and that they are unalienable to you individually, unalienable, then with the crown having all rights, then you lived as a serf. You could not do anything except at the pleasure of that dictator. And that's where we are today, too, as we increasingly give up power. Rather than having the assurance of protection from foreign marauders and from law violators as the exchange, we today have new promises of people that are part of the 20th century movement of socialism and communism around the world. And that is, these are disingenuous, they're lies, but they're promises that you can have a free education, you can have a guaranteed minimum income, you can have free drugs and free medical care, and you can have free child care. And these notions that these things are free is utterly false, because if the government spends money that it does not tax in order to pay for these things, then the public pays through inflation and is impoverished enormously. Look at Venezuela, over 1,000% inflation. Over 80% of the population is living in utter squalor. And then you have the other thing, which is if you're going to pay for it rather than impose the payment through inflation on the population, you do so by raising taxes. And if you raise taxes on the productive elements of society enough to pay for a thing of value, yep, they to be distributed universally,
they stop being productive.
You bankrupt the population.
Yep, exactly, yeah. Right. Jonathan, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there for this week. I am looking so forward to our discussion next week as we dig more into your book, The Authoritarians.
I appreciate it very much. It's been fun.
Be sure to join us next week when we fully dig into Jonathan's book that will truly help you understand how we got here, how socialist and communist thinking crept into and got a stranglehold on America's constitution and way of life. Then, as now, it's a justification for control to create slaves and masters. And we'll look at how to untangle this and break the chains. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.